Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do you picture when somebody says college student? Many of us think first of a young person straight out of high school, strolling a tree-lined university campus, or maybe pulling an all-night study session in a dorm. But as my guest today wants to remind us, fully 45% of college students in the U.S. do not enroll right after 12th grade. These days, 2 out of 5 of them are over 25, and many of those are juggling work, family, and financial responsibilities along with writing papers and preparing for exams, meaning they need different kinds of support to succeed than young people for whom school is the singular priority. Mike Rose is professor at the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies. His new book is Back to School, Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education, and our talk with him today is part of KERA's North Texas American Graduate Initiative. Mike, welcome to Think.
Well, thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
We give so much attention to the country's most elite universities, but for millions of hardworking Americans, these are far less relevant than the nearest community college. Why do they so often, why do they get left out of the conversation about post-secondary education?
Well, it's a good question because I agree with what you just said. The real action, it seems to me, in terms of American education is going on in the community colleges and in all the state colleges and local colleges around the country. I mean, that's where the vast majority of students go to school. But you're right, the attention tends to go to, you know, that top 25 in the U.S. News and World Report annual report. And I guess, you know, part of the reason is status, of course, and people are transfixed kind of on the, you know, the Ivy League and the research universities and flagship universities in the States. But it's really a small percentage of students who are getting their education there. So that's why I like to look at these other places, because that's where I think the future lies.
Double the number of people today over 40 in college than we had in the 1980s. What accounts for that shift?
Yeah. You know, it goes along with other shifts, too, like also twice as many single parents. You mentioned earlier about the average age of students. The average age of the community college student is 28 years. And I think, as with any shift like that, Chris, there's multiple reasons. One, you know, a generation or two ago, people could move into the middle class from the working class through good manufacturing jobs and other kinds of jobs that required a high school diploma or less. My uncles made it that way. Well, we all know what's happened to most of those kinds of jobs, so there's that reality. And another thing is that there's been an interesting cultural shift in the country, that over the last 3-4 decades, there's been this gradual move toward believing that more and more people really could be able to go to college, that it wasn't just a place for, you know, the upper crust or the more privileged. And then, of course, right now, in the last 3 or 4 years with the recession, I think you just got a lot of folks who are trying to get a leg up on things, and they're going back to school.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear from people who say, essentially, I was laid off and I'm struggling to find work, so I figured I will use this time, now that it's available to me, to try and get some more education.
Right. Yeah, and when you go to, you know, when you spend time in these schools, as I have, you run into a fair number of folks who are exactly in that situation. You know, they had work, they were employed, they built some skills, but those jobs went south. You know, you also have something like 600,000 veterans in school now. So these are people who were, you know, many of them had jobs before they were deployed, and they were on 2, sometimes 3 or more tours. So they're coming back also at an employment disadvantage, and they're trying to, you know, build their skills and move on to the next economic level for themselves.
A lot of veterans end up in a tough spot because skills they picked up in the military don't necessarily count in the civilian world. In other words, you know, people who were driving really elaborate vehicles still need to go through school and get a commercial truck license if they want to do that for a living.
Right. You know, and so when you talk to vets and when you talk to people who work with vets, on the one hand, they say, and they're right about this, that, you know, your veteran is going to be more mature. Some of them have been through things we can only begin to imagine, and that has certainly contributed as well to their, you know, desire to buckle down and do well. They learn a lot by being in the military. But the opposite is also true. That is, many of the kinds of things that they had to do don't easily transfer to civilian life. So they are in this kind of funny spot. They're coming back. They're hyper-motivated in many cases. They certainly are serious. But they're at certain kinds of disadvantages. And some of them haven't been in school in a long time, and when they were in school, maybe didn't do so well. So they also need additional services when they go to school, tutoring or trying to get up to speed on their math and their writing. So they're in a complex situation.
I realize that it's impossible to generalize about this, but talk about some of the reasons you've learned that students who are re-enrolled in school or enrolled after a long gap say that they didn't go right after high school.
Right. So, you know, it's just all the reasons you would imagine, ranging from folks who, you know, they just by their own admission, they messed up. They got into trouble, or they didn't care about school, or they got caught up in the streets, and many of them didn't graduate. Or if they did graduate, it was just barely. So you've got folks on that side of the spectrum, and then it runs all the way to people who were doing okay, but they wanted to start a family, or they wanted to enter the workforce. You know, in a lot of cases with low-income folks, they had no choice. They had to go to work to help support their own families, you know, their parents and their siblings. So there's those kinds of reasons. There's the classic, and we all know some of these folks, there's these classic kid who just couldn't bear school, you know, was bright, could do it if she wanted to, but it just wasn't for her. So it's really a range of reasons why people didn't go right from high school into college, do the kind of traditional thing.
So at the point, Mike, that they return and they do want to get a degree or they want to pick up some additional skills, tell us a little bit about the factors that affect how ready individual students are to take on the coursework they find at their local state school or at a community college or even at a sort of adult education training program.
Right. So there's the kind of stuff, Chris, that we were just talking about, you know, the level of preparation. And again, some students are coming back to school and they're pretty well prepared. Maybe they need, you know, an extra course in writing or a brush-up course in math. But then you've got people who really do need pretty serious remediation. They need a couple math courses. They need some writing courses. There's all those factors. And all of that's going to affect how well they do, right? How long it takes them to make their way through, how assured they feel, all of those things. Now, those are student factors. But, you know, there's a lot of other things, too, that play into whether or not they succeed and whether or not they're able to persist. And these are the kinds of things that you mentioned in your lead. They've got families. There's responsibilities. There's debt. There's transportation problems. There's child care problems. There's all those kinds of things. And then let's not forget that yet another layer is how well does the school respond to their needs, right? I mean, this is a big issue. Does the school look at its students through the students' eyes? You know, does the school understand the kinds of challenges that these folks face and the services they might need? So there's layers here. There's individual factors, there's factors related to their life situation, and there's institutional factors. All of that's going to determine how well they do, how well they persist, and if they succeed.
So, I mean, I attended a sort of traditional four-year university. I don't know how the school would have responded if I'd said, look, the job I'm working, you know, almost full-time needs me to be there from Monday through Thursday of next week, no exceptions. What will you do? How are local schools a little bit better at managing those kinds of issues that come up for students, or do they end up being pretty hard-lined about it?
Well, you know, it varies. You hit the nail on the head because more than a few students who are at some of our community colleges and state schools are exactly in that situation. They've got families. They've got jobs that are full-time or close to it. So Does the school offer courses at night or on the weekend? What about counseling? How available is counseling? And does it take place in hours other than just, you know, 10 to 5 or 10 to 4? What we've seen, or what I've been able to see, and a lot of others too who look at these sorts of things, is that different schools are just responding to these needs more effectively than others. And it makes a difference, because those schools that are able to do that, they have higher success rates. Students are able to persist longer. They're able to succeed. They're able to get a credential or a degree. But it really, you know, you have to look at what the institution's trying to do to respond to this very different population. As you said, it's not a bunch of students coming right out of high school at 18 with few responsibilities. These are people who are really carrying a heavy load.
And in the defense of the schools, it is challenging. If you have, you know, a class of 30 students in an introductory biology class, and, you know, 11 of them will need special accommodations over the course of a semester, that's not easy to do for everyone.
Yeah. And it's a good point. And believe me, I'm not trying to demonize anybody here.
No, that's apparent by reading the book, but continue.
Yeah, thanks. But let's see, how can I put this? But there is, it seems to me, a certain degree of responsibility mm-hmm. on the part of the institution. I mean, as a number of administrators and teachers said to me, you know, these are our students. They are here. And therefore, we have to respond to their needs. Now, having said that, you're absolutely right. It requires resources. And especially at a time like now when budgets are being slashed, a lot of colleges are having to cut classes and they're having to cut services at the very time when their students need them the most. So that's really a strain on the institution. How do they meet all these needs at a time of austerity when you have increasing numbers of people who want to go back to school, but when budgets are being cut? So in defense of the institution, number one, they are facing real financial constraints. The second thing to say is it's really hard to change an institution like a college. I mean, what did someone once say? This is a great old saying, that changing a curriculum is like trying to move a graveyard. But it's that difficult mm-hmm. because people get entrenched and there's traditional ways of doing things and, well, we've always taught it this way and, you know, all that kind of thing. Plus, in a lot of these schools, people are teaching 4 and 5 classes a semester. And if those classes are writing classes, just think of, I mean, how do you start to change all that? So you've got the austerity issue, and then you've got the business of just trying to change traditional institutions, which is not easy and calls for real leadership and real vision from the top.
Mike Rose is with us. He is professor at the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies and author of the new book, Back to School, Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education. We're speaking with him today as part of KERA's North Texas American Graduate Initiative. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. Would love to hear from you, particularly if you are one of those non-traditional students who is doing it now, has returned to school, or did so in the past. Give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program and Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mike Rose. He's professor at the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies and author of the new book, Back to School, Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think at kera.org. Mike, I want to talk about another challenge that students face who have remedial needs when they arrive at school. 20 years after leaving college, if I had to go back and take an undergraduate level calculus course, I think I might have to go back to like eighth or ninth grade to ramp up, which is all well and good. But if I were, you know, a struggling single parent working full time, paying for those courses that gave me no credit, that might seem like a hurdle that was too high to pass.
Well, you just nailed it, Chris. I mean, one of the big problems with right now that a lot of schools are facing is exactly that. So you have students who come in, and as you say, they have a lot of responsibilities. And they have to take, maybe they're held for two or three or even four courses that are not going to give them graduation credit because, as you say, they're remedial. They come before the, you know, the freshman level course. And what a lot of research has shown is that that's where people falter. And it makes sense, right? Because you're stuck there for a year, maybe even longer, taking those courses. You're not moving toward your goal of accumulating units toward a certificate or a degree. And it gets really frustrating. So one thing that is exciting right now is that a lot of really smart people around the country who work in these schools have been rethinking that whole model. They're asking themselves questions like, how can we move students more quickly through this series but still educate them well? Has our curriculum been wrong? You know, if students are having such a hard time, maybe we've been doing this the wrong way. We've been focusing too much on skills and drills kind of stuff, let's say, and we need to move to something different. How about extra services? What if we figure out a way to add, you know, an extra hour to the class and have that be tutorial? How about this? What if we hook our math courses and our writing courses onto other courses that students are taking for credit and that are part of their goal? So, for example, you know, your math course is connected to your diesel automotive course. Your writing course is connected to your fashion or cosmetology course. So there's a lot of different ways that people are experimenting right now. To see if they can make these courses more relevant, move more quickly, and be more connected to college credit in a more expeditious and quicker way. So, it's a good time right now. There's a lot going on that's addressing the very problem you raise.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Ken in Fort Worth. Hi, Ken.
Hi, Chris. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to share something with you and to make a suggestion. My life, I started college right after high school. Met my wife. We got married. I continued going to school. And suddenly, after working full-time at a job and going to school and having three kids, I couldn't make it. So I dropped out for 20 years. Went back to school, got my degree. The school didn't make any exceptions for me, and I didn't particularly need any. But it can be done without the university making any changes. And my suggestion would be if kids going to college do not have enough of something and have to take remedial classes, I'm sorry, but they need to do it. Let's not make so many exceptions that the curriculum is valueless.
What do you think, Mike?
Well, I'm glad Ken is actually raising a couple points. One is that, sure, it can be done, and he's a living example of somebody who did it without the institution making any alterations in the way it did things. But Ken's story is an exceptional one, and I'm not so sure that we can create national policy around these issues based on the exceptions, because it'll mean just a smaller and smaller percentage of people to succeed. So big congratulations to Ken, absolutely, on quite an achievement, but Ken is more the exception than the rule. Now, the second thing he said about the remedial courses, in what I was saying, I hope it didn't sound like I was suggesting that we wanted to release students from those obligations. That would not be doing them any favors whatsoever. I mean, if we just zoomed students through where we said, oh, instead of taking, you know, instead of reaching this level of proficiency in writing, we're just going to ratchet it down so that they make it through. If that's what we do, then we're committing, it seems to me, a real educational crime. And Ken would be absolutely right. The kind of thing I'm talking about, and I've been involved in doing this kind of work for some time, in fact, is making the courses more challenging, more like college courses, more substantial in their content and in the way they're taught. And I think you can achieve that and also achieve a kind of speeding up of the process, as well as making the courses more relevant and more connected to students' ability to gain some credit for what they're doing.
So, Mike, there are skills that students need related to the facts that they need to remember and be able to access in a class. There are other things like critical thinking, like recognizing the importance of time management, like learning how not simply to write but to structure a paper, that are a little more slippery maybe than what remedial education might offer. There's even the issue that you raise of knowing when to ask for help. What do we do for students who are struggling with these skills?
Yeah, and you know, that's a lot of people. And let me tell you, you're going to find that in the Ivy League as well as at the local community college. Students who need to learn how to live within an institution. I mean, it is a different kind of existence in a way, learning how to ask help in a place as big and vast as a college, right? I mean, that is a... It sounds funny to say it, but it's a learned skill. It's not something you necessarily know automatically. Now, kids who grow up in an environment where there's a lot of that going on and where parents have gone to college and they're able to advise their children, some of that comes a little more easily. But if you've never gone to college and nobody in your family has, and this whole landscape is new to you, you're right. People need extra help with that, and I think that the good college classroom at a community college, for example, helps students learn that sort of thing. So does a tutoring center. So does good counseling. These are the kind of services I'm talking about. You're absolutely right, Chris. It's not just that we want to help people put two sentences together in a better way. We're after bigger fish here. You know, we're after helping people become learners and helping people learn how to navigate an institution and how to ask questions and how to seek help and how to figure out a difficult problem. These are the kind of meta skills that come, I think, with a good education. And some students come to these institutions, come to adult school, come to college, and they just haven't had that much experience.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Cynthia in Dallas. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, how are you? Thank
Good.
You, Chris, for having me on your show.
Welcome.
I was just calling because you guys were talking about experiences, and I am what you call a non-traditional student. I actually just took my last final
Way
an
to go.
Hour ago. Yeah. And so I walk on Sunday, and you guys were talking about certain things, and it was very important when I went back, it had been 25 years, that at least in the admission part, the school I went to, I chose that school because they held my hand. They showed me how things work on Blackboard and, you know, computers and things like that that you just sort of aren't into anymore if you're not 20 years old. But I also think when you're talking about critical thinking that that's really important, and maybe some of the prep work that's being done, people really don't. I think we're overestimating what a four-year university degree is here, and that maybe junior college and tech schools, there's nothing wrong with that if you look at around the rest of the world.
Thanks so much for your call. What do you think about all that, Mike?
Well, first of all, do we have like a little automatic applause track?
We need like the hallelujah chorus. Good for Cynthia, right?
Exactly right. Congratulations to Cynthia. Well, first of all, she's absolutely right about the fact that, you know, you don't have to, again, you don't have to go to an Ivy League school to get a good education and an education that's going to help you achieve your goals. I want to jump on something that she mentioned when she talked about computers, and because it's representative of the kind of thing we're talking about here. Ken, your earlier caller, was out of school 20 years. Cynthia was out 25 years. I mean, there's a lot of folks who you run into in these institutions who match that profile. It's been a very long time since they've been in school, and things have changed dramatically in terms of electronic technology.
Mm-hmm.
So at some of the colleges I've been at, they make it a point of you know, having a course or some kind of an orientation to just help people learn how to use the computer in order to access their services or look at their records or make appointments. Again, these are things that, you know, that may seem so basic and so remedial if you're, you know, 19 and you're going through school fine and your family knows the ropes. But, boy, when you're in a position like Cynthia's, all of this stuff can be utterly overwhelming. And it's part of the reason why people don't persist. It's why they don't continue. It's not just, oh, I'm having trouble with my history class. It's all this other stuff that can be just overwhelming.
We've had several people write in and address the issue of these online courses that are becoming available, particularly for remedial students. And I know that a lot of smaller institutions, I don't want to call them, let's call them non-name brand institutions, are a little concerned about some of these online courses because they fear that they may actually draw students away from their four-credit classes. But what do you think is the role for massive, are they massive open online courses in the kind of education that we're talking about today?
Yeah. So you know, you raised the even bigger issue than these, I guess they call them MOOCs, right?
Right.
Massive open online courses. Let's go to the whole business of the advent of the computer into education here, because we're seeing it happen rapidly where, you know, if you go into any community college, for example, you'll find a number of courses that are using electronic technology, using the computer. So students are doing some of their work on computer and some at home. These are called hybrid courses. And then you've got these situations where people are doing all their work on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a completely online course. And then you've got a lot of institutions that just provide the degree solely online, right? And then you've got this situation of these MOOCs, that is, these courses that are that offer offer entire curriculum online, and people can take them, and they can take them in conjunction with regular courses in a regular college, or they can take them alone. So this stuff is just proliferating. As with any new technology, Chris, you know, there's tremendous promise here, and there's also big worries.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the kind of worries you're talking about that institutions have. You know, will they be made irrelevant? Will these courses drain away their students? I don't think that's going to happen. But what does concern me is the inappropriate or the superficial use of these kinds of technologies. These technologies work best when they really are integrated into some kind of a full curriculum, and when they're used in a thoughtful way, and when they're not just a kind of workbook thrown up on a screen. So let's take that remedial writing course we were talking about earlier. Let's take that as an example. If what a student gets is just a bunch of modules with a kind of old-fashioned grammar workbook thrown up on a screen, that's hardly an advance. That's hardly using the technology to its best effect.
Sure.
Another aspect of remedial work that we know is that people often need more than just the skills. They need the encouragement. They need people who are there who can tell them, you know what, you can do it, and here's how you do it. And if they're solely online, they're not going to get that either. So the big question for me around all this stuff is, how is it being used, and how is it being integrated into the whole education that someone's getting? It's not enough if they just can go in, knock off a few modules, say they've completed the thing and that's done. That's not a guarantee that they're going to get any kind of a decent education. I think we're at a big crossroads right now. I think one direction we could go is we're going to see the proliferation of more and more of these kinds of, you know, computer instruction approaches. And it's going to be done just to save money. It's going to be done to get more people. And it's not going to be done thoughtfully. The other direction we could go, and some places are doing this, is where these technologies are integrated much more thoughtfully and carefully into a curriculum. And they're not just, you know, they're not just there to kind of fill people's time or to have them go through routines mechanically. This is the crossroads we're at.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Katie in Dallas. Hey, Katie.
Hi. I just wanted to speak to the remedial classes that are being offered. And I'm a non-traditional student who went back to school after 18 years and tested into pre-algebra. And, you know, it was a huge benefit for me to go through all of those remedial math courses before I could get through into the regular algebra and statistics classes, because I had that, I'm a girl, I'm bad at math, I can't do it, it's so hard. And through being able to take these courses, maybe it's because it was at a later age, but it bolstered me. I got A's in all of my courses, and it made me realize, hey, I really can do this. And you know, I'm now graduating magna cum laude from one of the UT schools, and that was a great way to get my feet wet and get back in school and get me on the road and on the path that I needed to take. So,
what a great story. Thank you so much for sharing that, Katie. And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Mike Rose, who is professor at the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies. His new book is called Back to School: Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Mike Rose. He's professor at the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies and author of Back to School: Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education. A nice follow-up email to Katie's call before the break, Mike, comes from Dormond, who points out that some community colleges excel at providing the schools that high schools failed to deliver. Dormond asks, any thoughts on how we might improve the effectiveness of our secondary schools so that a higher portion of diploma holders might be able to perform once they are in college?
Right. Can we stick with Katie just for a second?
Absolutely.
Because we want to play that hallelujah chorus for her, too.
Once again. Well, let's let it go the whole hour. It's all very good news here.
She brought up a couple of things I would love to talk about. And one is that she reminds us that there's a lot of remedial courses that are done very well and really do make a difference in people's lives. And so I hope that some of the earlier conversation, I didn't give the impression that, you know, it was one vast wasteland. Absolutely not at all. But the thing that she talked about touches on what I was trying to get to with that answer about the computers. It was the kind of personal side of instruction. You know, she said she walked into those math classes with that, I'm a girl, I'm bad at math attitude, right? And I can't tell you how much time when I was teaching these courses, how much time I would spend with people trying to get a sense of what their history was with writing, you know? What was writing like for you in school? Tell me about some of the experiences you had. And then when I would look at a particular assignment that they had and they did something that maybe didn't quite work, I would ask them what their reason was for this. This is an interesting thing you did here. Can you talk to me about this? And it's this kind of discussion, you know, around a piece of writing. What's your history with this writing business, and why are you doing what you're doing right here, and what do you think about it, and what are your attitudes and beliefs about it? It's that kind of stuff that is just as powerful as showing people where a semicolon goes, you know, in fact, more so, because it gets to some of the really deep barriers that keep them from doing well in math or writing or reading, and that's what Katie got to. And that's why it's so important, I think, to have at least some time where you are connected to a human being who's skillful and thoughtful about this work. A computer alone can't do that. Now, to get to Dorman's question. So, yeah, it's terrible, isn't it? I mean, there's no other word for it, that so many folks come out of K through 12, and they do really lack basic skills in mathematics or writing. And you know, it's been a cause of national attention for some time now, right? It's the impulse behind so much of school reform. It's a hard question to answer easily because the reasons are so multifold. You know, some schools are just really challenged. They're under-resourced. They're in poor neighborhoods. The students themselves come with huge challenges. Keeping a roof over their heads and making it to school safely. So there's so many reasons behind the fact that some schools in our country are just doing a really poor job. But what's important, I think, Chris, is that if you have a society where you've got that kind of imbalance, that kind of inequality, if you will, in the nature of the education that people get in K through 12, and if you also want to have an open educational system, that is, if you really want to have educational opportunity, then you have to have some kind of a remedial something in this kind of space between high school and college. You know, Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, at some conference last year said he wanted to get community colleges out of the remediation business. Well, I think if he did that, then we would see the closing down of educational opportunity. Because if you are having students coming out of K through 12 and they're not prepared, what are you going to do with them? You have to have some kind of a place, some kind of an opportunity for them to build those skills that will enable them to proceed. Now, that's not, when I say things like that, people say, oh, then you're trying to ignore the problems with K through 12. Not at all. But I am saying that unless something dramatically changed tomorrow, some unprecedented shift in the way the country's organized and the way education happens, we're going to need this remedial function to help people get to the next level in their own educational journeys. It's just got to be there. And you know what? It's been part of higher education since the mid-1800s. The remedial course, the remedial program has been around since higher education's been around, just about.
You know, Mike, the subtitle of your book refers to second chances, but some of the students that you write about here have finally made it after their third or fourth or even fifth try at this. Some people look at the dropout rates, the class attrition rates, particularly for community and regional colleges, and are really scandalized by those and say, well, we need to tighten things up. I wonder if you think sort of cutting students off after a couple of tries, ultimately just rather than inspiring them to continue, it just makes it impossible for them to ever get to that place where everything clicks and they're able to graduate.
Sure. And you know, you are hearing that opinion voiced. You know, you hear it in state houses and you hear it from educational critics. You hear it from some administrators themselves in the colleges. You know, they're wondering if the classic open access community college, if that model just doesn't work. Because as you say, the open door allows a lot of folks to come in who, you know, are there for their second, third, fourth time. Their skills are really low, and they do have an immensely difficult time, and they do drop out at significant rates. That's, again, just not an easy question to answer. I completely understand the impulse to say, you know, there's only so much we can do with the limited resources we have. But, you know, Chris, I then ask the question, well, where exactly do we draw the line? And what do we put in place? So if we say, let's say we say, you know what, if somebody scores below this certain level on an entrance test, we're not going to admit them to, they're not going to come into the community college, then what is there in its place? Well, the adult school is what's there. But when you look around the country, a lot of adult school budgets are being slashed. In Los Angeles, the adult school budget was slashed by 3/4 last year.
Hmm.
So this affects 250,000 people in Los Angeles. So if we do put these limits and these barriers, and I could understand the need to do that, what are we going to put in its place? Because, again, if we want to live up to our best image of ourselves, to our best definition of the United States, we are an opportunity society. We are a society of second and third chances. We just need to have these opportunities available to people, because the thing that fascinates me as I spend time in these institutions is you don't know on day one who it is that's going to end up being successful. And sometimes it's that person who starts out so low down the line, you can't believe it. And then 3 and 4 years later, there they are getting their certificate, getting their associate's degree, and moving on in their lives. Extraordinary stories. And I try to tell these stories in the book because I think that they remind us of what it means to live in a society that does have these kinds of opportunities for people.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Aaron in Fort Worth. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. The problem that I'm a non-traditional student as well, and the problem that I run into in pursuing my educational goal is the two problems are cost and schedule. At the University of Texas at Dallas, they do a graduated tuition rate where the first hour is very expensive and subsequent hours get less expensive. So if you can take 15 hours, it's like, and I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but it's like $380 an hour. But if you're only taking one class, you're paying like $700 an hour. And that feels to me like punishment for going slow.
Hmm.
And the other problem that I run into because I have to work and have family obligations and all that stuff, is scheduling, where I'm running into classes that are offered once a year on Tuesday and Thursday, and that's when you take it or you don't graduate ever. And so I'm just curious to know what's being done to look at these kinds of situations that are
real for people like you, Aaron.
That are real and that are logistical barriers and not content barriers.
What about that, Mike?
Yeah. Well, he's absolutely right. I mean, and he gets back to something we were talking about way at the beginning, and that is is an institution able to look at itself through its students' eyes? So you take a guy like Aaron, and he's saying, my God, here's this class, and it's given once a year on these two, these times on these 2 days. That's an institution, I think, that's not being as responsive as it needs to be to students like Aaron. And if they have a significant number of students like Aaron, then I think what can you say other than that they need to make some kind of shift if they want to hold on to people like him and do right by people like him? The first thing he said is an example of what I was talking about, of an institutional attempt to assure that people take more courses, move along more quickly. These are some of those barriers that you talked about in your last point. Are there certain constraints or certain ceilings or floors that institutions should put in place to kind of make sure that the students who are coming through are going to, be more likely to follow a pattern that's going to lead to success. So that graduated tuition idea may have behind it a very good intention. That is, we want students to take more units because if they take more units, they graduate more quickly. But Aaron's giving us an illustration of the downside of that remedy. I know a number of students, I write about some of these folks in Back to School. I know a number of students who started out taking one class, and that was all they could take. Then they had to work. Then they couldn't take a class the next term. Then they took another class. They had to work. They took another class. And in bingo, it starts to click, right? And so sometimes it's those very students who can only take a course at a time who are the ones who are going to end up being your success stories, and you might not know that at the beginning of the journey.
I wonder about the issue of attaining knowledge for its own sake. And I know for some people really struggling in this country, that sounds like a luxury and a pipe dream. But what do we do to avoid going so far over into the idea of school as something you do for its economic value that we lose our embrace of learning for the mere pleasure of sort of growing one's mind?
Yeah. That's a huge question. I think it's very important because, you know, Chris, if you listen to political speeches and you read the opinion page and all that over the last couple decades, really just about the only justification you hear for education, K through 12 or college, is an economic one. You know, kids go to school and adults go to school because we want them to become more economically viable, and then as a society, we want to become, you know, more economically stable. That leaves out so many other reasons why people go to school. So point number one, I think you're absolutely right that we need to remind ourselves that we as human beings learn things for more than just economic benefit. And here's what's so interesting to me. When you spend time in program, in these occupational programs in the community colleges, people are there and they say this flat out because they want to get a leg up, they want to get a better job. The more they talk, though, and the more questions you ask them, all these other reasons in line with what you're mentioning come out. They are also there because they want to learn new things. They want to read and write better. They want to be role models for their kids. They want to be better able to help their kids with schooling. And in some cases, they say even things like, you know, I didn't do this right the first time, and I really want to get it right now. Or, you know, I need to turn my life around. So it even gets to that level of transformation, right? So suddenly, even in these programs that are very geared toward an occupation, as people talk about their motivations, it turns out that they have all these other reasons to be coming back to school as well.
Mike Rose is professor at the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies. His new book is called Back to School, Why Everyone Deserves a Second Chance at Education. We invited him on the show today as part of KERA's North Texas American Graduate Initiative. Mike, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, Chris, thank you. It went really quickly. Thank you so much.
Today's show was engineered by Alan Roberts. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer with help today from Lindsay Connect. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.